This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Ohio, Indiana, Iowa, New Jersey, and especially in Wisconsin, the bitter battles over state budgets center on public workers, their salaries, benefits, retirement obligations, and collective bargaining rights of teachers, cops, firefighters, sanitation workers, and many more, including, yes, bureaucrats. We'll get an update from Madison in just a moment. But we want to focus today on competing and sometimes contradictory claims about public employees. Public sector workers make more than private sector workers. Public sector workers make less than private sector workers. Public union pensions are bankrupting states. Public union pensions have nothing to do with state budgets. Public employees contribute nothing towards their gold-plated benefits. Public workers contribute more than some private sector employees. We're going to have a lot to cover this hour. So today we'd just like to see emails, no phone calls, please. Send us your email. What myth or reality about public workers would you like us to fact check? Our email, talk@npr.org. I'll repeat that, talk@npr.org. You can also write to us on our website. Go to npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. First, though, to Wisconsin and another dramatic day at the state capitol after Republicans in the state Senate passed a bill last night that sharply limits collective bargaining rights for public employees. Jason Stein, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joins us from Madison. A busy day, no doubt.
It's good to be with you, Neil. Very hectic.
And what's going on right now?
Right now, the Assembly is debating Governor Walker's bill on the budget and union bargaining rights. The Assembly Minority Leader, a Democrat, has just called for the removal of the Republican Speaker because he says his judgment is impaired. Police cleared demonstrators from before the Assembly chambers to allow lawmakers to enter and begin debating the bill.
And when you say cleared, some of them were carried out.
They were bodily removed.
And so this is an angry day.
This is, you know, extremely heated confrontations. Yet we've seen fewer injuries that we've seen. So it's been peaceful, but extremely heated and extremely bitter.
And the outcome seems, not in dispute.
The Assembly Speaker said only moments ago, this is the Republican leader of that body, that Republicans would pass the bill today and cut off debate if needed to do so.
And Governor Walker is expected to sign it how long after it's passed?
I would expect very quickly, although we've not been given a time frame.
And would that prevent the issue of the layoffs that he'd threatened before?
He has said the bill is needed to prevent layoffs of up to 1,500 state employees before June 30th. Democrats have said that there are other ways to do that. And I am here in the state capitol. You may hear as the door to the press room opens and closes the sound of people chanting outside.
And they're chanting outside the Capitol building or they're chanting inside?
Inside the Capitol Rotunda, as well as demonstrating outside.
And how many people would you estimate?
Neil, I couldn't tell you. We haven't received an official estimate. I believe it would be safe to say they would number in the thousands at this point.
And the state senators, the Democrats, the 14, have they returned after they were outmaneuvered last night and the Republicans passed the bill just by themselves?
They have not. There was some initial statements and speculation that they would return immediately today. That since there's been some statements and counterstatements about when they might return, we'll just say at the moment we haven't gotten a clear question. It doesn't appear to be today, but all aspects of this situation are extremely fluid.
And after this bill passes, after the governor signs it, what happens then?
Well, recall efforts are underway for almost every senator in the state of Wisconsin who can be recalled. That will play out over the coming months. This budget repair bill that Governor Walker put forward is just a prelude to a much bigger battle over the two-year state budget that starts in July 1st. So we'll have a number of contentious things occupying us even after this bill passes.
And would I be wrong to suspect that some people may take their case to court?
I think so. I believe a legal challenge has already been filed today. There's many aspects of this story, and I'm not on that one directly, but it's very safe to say that there will be a lot of legal maneuvering over the passage of this bill.
Have you ever seen anything quite this contentious there in Madison?
Nothing that could even be compared to it. It's orders of magnitude larger, you know, than anything we've ever seen.
And who seems likely to benefit? The governor has seemingly prevailed, and his bill will pass. The Democrats, well, they've lost the bill, but they say they may have won the war.
They say this is a Pyrrhic victory for the governor. They say they're making headway in their recall efforts and raising a lot of money, in the state and nationally over this for efforts like recalls. We will see. You know, the Republicans say they're going to attempt to recall Democrats over their Democratic senators for leaving the state. It's a stay tuned situation for all of it.
And you said some senators are not able to be recalled. How come?
Because you need to be in office for a year or more to be recalled. And like I think many Senate bodies, our Senate, half of them get elected every 2 years. So half of them were elected in November and wouldn't be eligible for recall at this moment.
Jason Stein, thanks very much for your time today. We know you're very busy.
Thank you, Neil.
Jason Stein, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joined us by phone from their bureau there at the State House in Madison. For many working and unemployed Americans barely making through these hard economic times, it may seem public employees have a sweet deal with the help of their unions, but is that the case? What are the truths about public employees and the unions that represent them? Stephen Greenhouse joins us from our bureau in New York. He's the labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times and has been our guide on many of these stories. Stephen, nice to have you back with us today.
Nice to be here, Neil.
And I just want to ask a little bit more about what's going on in Wisconsin. We know you were there recently and what's brewing in a few other states. Give us a quick 101, if you would, on collective bargaining rights. For those not familiar with how unions work, what exactly are they?
Collective bargaining rights, workers... When a majority of workers at a workplace choose to have a union, the union becomes their representative to bargain with management over things like wages. And non-union workplaces, basically, you yourself can try to, ask for a raise, beg for a raise, or you'll just wait for your manager to say, okay, you're getting a raise. With a union, there are formal procedures for, the union representative to sit down with management to bargain what your health plan is going to be, what your hours are going to be, what overtime rules might be, and what your wages might be. And the rules are somewhat different in the private sector and the public sector, Neil, because the private sector, federal legislation, the National Labor Relations Act sets the rules for private sector workers unionizing. Every state can set its own rules on whether public sector workers can unionize. So in 1959, Wisconsin became the first state in the union that allowed its public sector workers to unionize. Now, with a Republican governor and Republican legislature, they want to take collective bargaining rights away from most public employees.
From most public employees. And it's do public employees have the right to strike?
In some states, yes. In some states, no. In Ohio now, where there's also legislation to, strip most collective bargaining rights of public employees, most public employees have the right to strike. That would be banned. In Wisconsin, generally, public employees do not have the right to strike. Ditto in New York State, where I'm talking. If a public employee goes on strike, he or she can go to jail.
And as you're talking about collective bargaining rights, how many states allow that and how many do not?
About three-quarters of the states allow their public employees to bargain collectively, and only about half the states can every public employee bargain. And in some states, it's a state employees but not local employees. In some states, it's teachers but not sanitation workers or cops. It varies. But there are about 10 states, roughly, that don't allow any of their public employees to bargain for a union contract.
I just wanted to check. Governor in Wisconsin, Scott Walker, published an editorial, an op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal, presumably written before the vote last night. But in any case, this outlines his opinion. He writes, "The unions say they are ready to accept concessions, yet their actions speak louder than words. Over the past 3 weeks, local unions across the state have pursued contracts without new pension or health insurance contributions. Their rhetoric does not match their record on this issue." We'd heard from a lot of union and public employee and Democrats in the state of Wisconsin, hey, we're willing to compromise on the economic issues, just not on the right to bargain collectively.
Neil?
Yeah.
So I was just in the New York Times newsroom talking with one of my fellow reporters who was on the phone with a lot of school boards in Wisconsin that have recently signed new contracts with their teachers. And those contracts call for the include the major concessions that Governor Walker has asked for. He's asked the public employees to start contributing 5.8% of their salary toward their pensions. He asked them to double their contribution for their health plans. So the workers will be paying 12% of their health care costs, up from 6%.
But did they still insist on collective bargaining?
And they're still insisting on collective bargaining. The unions say the governor asked for two big loaves, so to speak. One, these fairly significant economic concessions that would, in effect, reduce their take-home pay by 7 or 8%, having them pay more for pensions and health care. And the second big loaf he's asking for is basically eliminating most collective bargaining rights. And the unions have been saying, we've made this huge concession to agree to basically reduce our take-home pay by 7, 8%. Now, Governor, why don't you meet us halfway and stop demanding an end to most bargaining rights? And he says, clearly what's happening in the state Senate and the state assembly today shows that, he's going to be able to enact this. But he's argued that he needs a great diminution, a great weakening of collective bargaining rights to help the state and its many cities and counties balance their budgets in years to come.
And quickly, this, again, from Governor Walker's op-ed. When Governor Mitch Daniels repealed collective bargaining in Indiana 6 years ago, it helped government become more efficient and responsive. The average pay for Indiana state employees has actually increased, and high-performing employees are rewarded with pay increases or bonuses when they do something exceptional.
I did a story about what's happening in Indiana, and it's true that when he issued the executive order in 2005 ending collective bargaining for state employees, it gave him far more latitude, more flexibility to decide to contract out outsource operations, and he often has done that by contracting with companies that will pay their workers less or not provide benefits. But the workers say it really hasn't saved that much money, that some of the privatization decisions really have backfired, and they say that they often haven't gotten raises and that it's hurt their morale.
We're talking with Stephen Greenhouse. The New York Times is with us to fact-check assumptions we sometimes make about what it's like to be a public worker. Have you heard one you're not too sure about? Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Think of Selma and Patty working in the Springfield Department of Motor Vehicles in The Simpsons, or that old chestnut that puts police officers in the donut shop instead of walking the beat. Public workers don't always get a lot of respect. And in conversations prompted by the budget battles in so many states this year, public servants are either the villains or the victims. So where's the truth? We have a lot of ground to cover today. We'd just like to read your questions, not take phone calls, so find us online. What myth or reality about public workers would you like us to fact-check for you? Email talk@npr.org. You can also leave questions on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. With us is Stephen Greenhouse, the labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. With us from our bureau in New York, here's an email from Kate in Palo Alto. Is it true that public employees' mean salary is higher than for private employees?
Neil, you want me to answer?
I hope so.
Okay. First, how does, when one says salary, does one just mean basic wages, or does one also include healthcare and pensions? There are varying studies on that. Generally, when conservative think tanks do studies, they find that public sector workers earn somewhat more, a little more than private sector workers. There are studies by various academics and somewhat liberal think tanks that find that public sector workers actually earn less, especially when you factor in higher education levels. There was one study showing that public sector workers in Wisconsin earn more than private sector workers. But then when you looked at 60% of the public sector workers in Wisconsin have college degrees, whereas only 20% of private sector workers do. So that would, of course, explain that's a big reason why public sector workers in Wisconsin average higher wages, higher pay, because they have much greater education levels. I have in front of me a study by a nonpartisan group that has Republicans on its board of directors, the Center for State and Local Government Excellence. And they did a big study called Out of Balance? Comparing Public and Private Sector Compensation Over 20 Years. And they say wages and salaries of state and local employees are lower than those for private sector employees with comparable earnings determinants such as education and work experience. State workers typically earn 11% less and local workers 12% less. Then they add, when you factor in benefit costs like retirement and health care, state employees and local employees earn about 7% less than private sector employees. And they say the gap has been growing between public sector employees and private sector employees, with public sector employees falling further behind in recent years.
Here's another email, this one from Andrew in St. Peter, Minnesota. Is it unduly difficult to fire or lay off a unionized public employee?
I think if you're a school board president and feel that you have a teacher who's been there for 20 years or 30 years and hasn't been doing a very good job teaching, and that teacher has tenure, yes, you're going to feel it's very, very hard, unduly hard to fire teachers. You know, generally, public sector unions win so-called just cause clauses in their contracts that you can only be fired for just cause. Whereas for most workers in the economy, most non-union workers, most private sector workers, you're a so-called at-will employee. You could be fired at the will of the employer for whatever reason. Maybe he doesn't like the color of your eyelashes or your shoes that day. So generally, public sector workers have much greater protections against being fired. And in some of those protections are much more ironclad, like tenure, and some protections are not nearly as strong.
This is from an opinion piece for the Boston Globe by Paul Toner, a middle school teacher in Cambridge, president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. He writes, "The biggest myth is that our pensions are overly generous. Teachers pay about 90% of their own pension costs. Like other public employees, we do not participate in Social Security, saving taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars a year because the state does not contribute 6.2% of our salaries into that system."
He makes a good point, but I should add that pensions differ from state to state and city to city. You know, each state, each city, each school board generally has different pension rules for its workers. And some people say that when a teacher retires with 30 years on the job, with 30 years experience, and has a pension of $80,000, a lot of teachers will say, "I worked hard. I was a valuable teacher. I deserve $80,000." Other people will say, "$80,000 is a totally outrageous amount, especially when people are retiring at 55 or 57. And if that person remains alive for another 25, 30 years, it's going to cost the government about $2 million. Now, I know the gentleman from the Massachusetts Teachers Association will say, "Well, we help contribute to those pensions. We help pay for them." But others will say, still, the load, the burden for the taxpayer is too great, especially when the average American worker only earns about $35,000, $40,000 a year. And some people think it's just not fair when a pensioner is, say, making $80,000 a year.
Is it accurate to say that most public employees, in terms of their pensions, get defined benefits, i.e. X percent of your previous salary? Or do they get, like most work pension plans in the private sector, a defined contribution into their 401k?
Most public sector workers who are unionized get so-called defined benefit plans. And those are the types of pensions that many of our mothers and fathers have, that, once you retire at age, say, 63, every month of your life until you die, you receive a fixed amount. And in the public sector, these pensions, traditional pensions, remain very, very common. In the private sector, over the past 30 years, companies have usually moved away from defined benefit plans and towards 401ks. And for companies, they've done that for two major reasons, and both reasons end up hurting the employee. Companies didn't like when in a defined benefit plan, a company might promise that when you retire, it's going to pay $30,000 a year towards your pension. But if the stock market plunges, then the company is going to have to pump in a lot more money into your pension fund to help make sure that you can get your $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 a year. So the company wants to push the risk in going to 401ks, where the employee makes the payment. The companies wanted to shift their burden, shift the risk to employees. Secondly, when companies move from traditional pension plans to 401ks, they generally pay far less into 401ks. For typical pension plans, a company might pay 10% of a worker's salary per year. For 401ks, it's only about 3%. So companies much prefer 401ks. Now, a lot of private sector workers who have 401ks say, "I don't have a very good retirement plan anymore. This stinks." And they resent seeing public sector workers having more generous pension plans. And they say that's not fair. And the public sector workers will say, don't resent me for having the decent pension plan that your mothers and fathers used to have. You should fight to have a better pension plan for yourself.
Stephen Greenhouse is with us, labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times. We're just taking emails today, and we're reading from some op-eds as well. You can email us your question that you'd like to have fact check. The address is talk@npr.org. But here's from an op-ed written by Jonah Goldberg, editor-at-large of the National Review Online. This is from the Chicago Tribune. The argument for public unionization wasn't moral, economic, or intellectual. It was rankly political, he wrote. Private sector unions fight with management over an equitable distribution of profits. Government unions negotiate with friendly politicians over taxpayer money, putting the public interest at odds with union interests. And as we've seen in states such as California and Wisconsin, exploding the cost of government. The labor politician negotiations can't be fair when the unions can put so much money into campaign spending.
So I think Mr. Goldberg's history is off a little bit, because when public sector unions really took hold in the 1950s and 1960s, the main reason was they felt that they were treated shabbily on the job and they were generally earning less money than private sector workers. And, you know, eventually public sector workers, you know, many of them form unions, so much so that now more than half the nation's union members are government workers rather than private employees. Now, in some localities, in some cities, in some school boards, yes, the unions have helped elect, Democrats have helped elect friends who sit on the other side of the negotiating table. And yes, sometimes that means that maybe, you know, those friends whom you helped elect scratch your back and give you more generous wages or pensions than you otherwise might. However, a lot of other people are, you know, corporations, and a lot of folks are trying to, you know, elect their friends and try to make sure that politicians who have ever elected Democrats or Republicans, you know, won't be too generous for unions. And I often talk to union leaders who say, we wish we were half as powerful as Jonah Goldberg says, because if we had all the power he says, if we were so lucky in electing all our friends to be sitting on the other side of the negotiating table, then our wages would be much, 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 much better than wages for the private sector worker. So union leaders say it's grossly exaggerated how much power they have. But that's not to say that there aren't sometimes occasions when union friends on the other side of the bargaining table are too generous. That has happened sometimes, and sometimes that's really ended up being a burden for various towns and school boards.
Politics on the other side. This from Dick Pullman, a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Governor Scott Walker, in his second month on the job, seeks not only to extract economic concessions from these unions, but to bust them by stripping their bargaining rights, barring them from using worker dues for political operations, and forcing them to stage annual elections on whether they should remain in existence. Interestingly, the public unions that represent police and firefighters would be exempt from these rules. Perhaps it's sheer coincidence that Walker has exempted the folks who endorsed him in 2010.
Governor Walker argues that he's not trying to bust unions. He's saying that he's merely trying to help the state and local governments balance their budgets, and he wants to give them the tools, the flexibility to do so. And he says, you know, eliminating most collective bargaining would do that. He says he's exempted cops and firefighters from his restrictions on collective bargaining because he's worried that basically they would hold work protests and that would endanger public security, and he didn't want to risk that. Other people say no, he's just, you know, scratching their back because they had endorsed him in their election. I got lost. Sorry.
That's okay. You were talking about the public workers this is the argument that the fundamental motivation on the other side is rankly political to bust the unions.
Yes. So in 2005, the last time Republicans did very, very well in elections, Governor Mitch Daniels was elected in Indiana, Governor Matt Blunt was elected in Missouri, and they moved very quickly to eliminate collective bargaining for state workers. And they weren't saying so much. You know, they were saying, yes, we need to do this to balance our budgets, but there wasn't a budget crisis then nearly as bad as it is now. But, you know, Republicans don't like unions. Republicans don't generally like public sector unions, because they make it harder to balance the budget, and they are highly, highly Democratic generally. And this year, when Republicans swept to power in Wisconsin, Ohio, and other states, I don't think it's any coincidence that one of the first things they've done is try to restrict the power of public sector unions. I think a lot of Republicans were really angry when they saw the leaders of some public sector unions boasting that they spent $50 million, $90 million last fall trying to elect the Democrats. And I've spoken to numerous union leaders and numerous Democrats who say this is all political payback. They're trying to cut the unions off at the knees. And Governor Walker and many Republicans in Wisconsin say that's not the case at all. We're trying to help the taxpayer. We don't like having to have unions push, press the taxpayers for all sorts of concessions for higher pay for higher pensions. And they say all we're doing is not busting unions, but trying to, you know, ensure there's more flexibility to help reduce the deficits they face.
Stephen Greenhouse of The New York Times. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Email question from Evie. Are federal government employees unionized?
Yes, many federal employees are unionized. There's an election starting right now today for 44,000 transportation security officers at the nation's airport. And they're voting today. The ballots went out today, and over the next month they'll be voting on whether to join a union or whether to remain non-union. And I think most federal employees are unionized, but they subjects they can bargain over are more limited generally than for, say, local teachers. There are great restrictions on federal workers in bargaining about their wages and their benefits. And generally, state and local employees have much more latitude over what they can bargain. Although Governor Walker in Wisconsin, the bill in Wisconsin, would limit their bargaining to just one subject alone. They can no longer bargain over health coverage or workload. They can only bargain over what their basic wage would be. And that would be limited to the consumer. They could not receive wage increases over the consumer price index unless it went to a public referendum. And right now, with taxpayers feeling aggrieved and hating all these tax increases, I don't see many taxpayers voting to give public employees raises that are higher than the inflation rate.
Let me ask you a question about history then. Do you remember a time, has there ever been a time, when public employees have been so reviled?
I don't think there has been, Neil. And I've been speaking to some academics who say that back in the 1970s, when Prop 13 was passed in California, and to restrict property taxes, and was it property 2.5 in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. I believe, and there was a huge concern about fast rising property taxes, and many states passed restrictions. And at the time, much of the public was angry, resentful towards public employees, saying, you're a big reason that our property tax has been going up. But even so, I think the ambivalence, the resentment, the antagonism towards public sector workers was far, far, far lower in the 1970s than it is now. Now, I think there have been two major trends that have turned a lot of the public against public employees. One is that, for private sector workers, have really had it hard over the past 10 to 20 years. And I wrote a book about that, Neil. We've discussed it.
Yeah.
The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, where wages have been really stagnant for the typical worker. As we just discussed, they've been losing their good pensions of old and getting much worse 401ks. Millions and millions of workers don't have health coverage or can hardly afford to pay health coverage. People are being pushed to work harder on the job. So there's been that trend. And so a lot of private sector workers say, hey, I'm really stressed and strained. It's not right that public sector workers have it better than I do. And the second major force is there've been these humongous budget deficits for states, cities, school boards, the worst budget deficits really since the Great Depression. And those two factors together, private sector workers feeling squeezed and these huge deficits, I think have really helped turn many members of the public against public sector workers. Plus you have people like Chris Christie in New Jersey and Scott Walker in Wisconsin, who I think have been, happy to help whip up public sentiment against the public sector unions because they want to put public sector unions on the defensive. They want to wring important concessions from them. Shortly after Scott Walker was elected, he said, and I quoted him in a front page story in the New York Times, saying basically that public sector workers are the haves and private sector workers are the have-nots. And union people went berserk when they saw that quote, when I quoted that. They say the Koch brothers, the billionaire business brothers who are libertarians and have given lots and lots of money to Scott Walker's campaign, they'll say, those are the real haves. You know, everyone else are the have-nots. But to say that we union workers who earn $35,000 a year are the haves, they say, is ridiculous.
Stephen Greenhouse, as always, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Neil. Nice to be here.
Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace correspondent for the New York Times, with us from our bureau in New York. And again, much more later today on All Things Considered on today's dramatic developments in Madison, Wisconsin. When Trevor Bayne crossed the finish line first in the Daytona 500, he was the youngest driver ever to do so. Tom Bowles applauded. The problem, he was in the press box. Is that right or not? Stay with us. This is NPR News.